Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for October 9th, 2015. On today's show, we'll have more from Wednesday night's Moscow League of Women Voters City Council Candidates Forum. But first, this news. Two of the six Priest Rapids dam workers injured in an explosion yesterday afternoon are in critical condition at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. Three other workers injured at the Central Washington Dam were in satisfactory condition at Harborview, and one was treated at a hospital and released. A spokesperson for the Grant County Public Utility District, which employs the injured workers, said the explosion was the result of malfunctioning breakers for one of the dam's generators. Spokesperson Chuck Allen told the Tri-Cities Herald, when the switch malfunctioned, a large amount of electrical energy was released. Allen said the dam continues to operate in stable condition and there are no public safety issues as a result of the explosion. The explosion at the Columbia River Dam occurred at 4:15 p.m. yesterday. The Washington Supreme Court ruled yesterday the Department of Ecology exceeded its authority when it approved new water rights for the city of Yelm. The western Washington city of 7,500 people wanted the rights to supply water in the case of future growth. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court found the water rights could permanently reduce flows in the Nisqually River and other waterways to the point where they could no longer sustain fish. Justice Charles Johnson wrote, "Reductions in flows are allowed temporarily when officials determine an overriding public interest, but they are not allowed on a permanent basis." The Washington Department of Health and Human Services said there were 22 cases of West Nile virus statewide in humans this season, which is about twice as many as last year. There was one human death due to West Nile virus this year in the state. Health officials also say 35 horses got the disease this year, which is carried by mosquitoes. Of those, 15 died or were euthanized. A 24-year-old lawsuit by Hanford Downwinders against the Department of Energy and Hanford Contractors is winding down. Hanford defense attorneys say around 5,000 people originally filed claims saying their health was harmed by radioactive releases from the nation's nuclear reservation. Plaintiff attorney Richard Iman of Spokane told the Tri-Cities Herald the number is around 3,550. The Centers for Disease Control spent over $20 million in a multi-year study, which ended in 1999, which defendants say found no evidence of thyroid disease increase in residents from radioactive iodine emissions released during the 1940s. Some plaintiffs say they are skeptical about the results of the study. According to an Energy Department statement released Wednesday, the Department of Energy is pleased to see the long-standing matter resolved. Iman, who represents some of the downwind plaintiffs, said neither he nor the other 14 law firms representing downwinders are happy about the settlements. Iman told the Tri-Cities Herald plaintiffs in the case were forced into settlements because the attorney's fees were cost prohibitive. He also said because the court required multiple depositions for each plaintiff and advance payments for expert reports, the costs of litigation were overwhelming. Iman said he thought all the settlements were very unreasonable given injuries incurred by the downwinders. He said some were catastrophic. Even those who were not badly injured were not paid a reasonable compensation for what they went through. Iman said the amount paid out to his clients is only a small part of the entire defense case attorney fees. He said, from the very beginning, we dealt with a scorched earth defense. It could not have escaped the DOE that people were definitely subjected to radiation, kept secret from them until 1988. During a bellwether trial in 2005, a jury awarded a total of $545,000 to two downwinders with thyroid cancer, split on a third cancer case and awarded no money to three other plaintiffs with thyroid disease. In the split case, a jury in a retrial found the Hanford radiation did not cause thyroid cancer in Shannon Road. Eastern Washington outdoor cannabis growers are preparing for a record harvest this year. The Spokesman Review reports Crystal Oliver of Washington's Finest Cannabis, who's getting ready to cut her outdoor crop with her husband, said, "I would wager that Spokane County this year will have the largest marijuana harvest the world has ever seen." Based on Liquor and Cannabis Control Board numbers from last year, Oliver estimates Washington's Finest Cannabis grows about 20% of all the legal marijuana in Spokane County. Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board spokesperson Brian Smith said his department is gearing up for a record harvest, and Oliver's comment is sound. Oregon recreational cannabis stores began selling marijuana last week, and Portland TV station KGW reports recreational sales are above $11 million during the first week. State regulators say most outlets are still a year away from opening, but Governor Kate Brown's signature on a bill late last month means pot stores were allowed to open earlier than originally planned. Legal possession became law last July. Consumers will be allowed to purchase limited quantities of dried flowers, seeds, and plant starts, but no recreational edibles will be legally available until state regulators can register all of the new stores. According to Jonathan Modi of the Oregon Health Authority, which is the state's cannabis regulating agency, any current medical marijuana dispensary can sell recreational cannabis as long as the stores register with the Oregon Health Authority prior to the sales. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission will take over cannabis regulating duties from the Oregon Health Authority when regulators iron out rules governing cannabis sales in the state. Two conservation groups plan to sue the federal government because they say a plan to help save threatened bull trout in five western states falls short and even violates the Federal Endangered Species Act. Representatives of the environmental groups Alliance for the Wild Rockies, based in Montana, and Friends of the Wild Swan, also in Montana, informed the U.S. Department of Interior Wednesday of their plan to file a lawsuit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The groups are planning to sue over a recovery plan developed by the service in response to an earlier lawsuit filed by the same two groups that was settled last year. Alliance for the Wild Rockies Executive Director Mike Garrity told the Associated Press the Fish and Wildlife Service wants to, quote, redefine recovery to almost extinct, unquote. Garrity said the agency is lowering the bar for bull trout recovery so the government can delist it. Bull trout were listed as threatened in the lower 48 states in 1999. U.S. Senator Jim Risch is planning to reopen the Upper Lauksaw land exchange proposal next month with a hearing at Grangeville to gather public input on the issue. The Lewiston Tribune reports Senator Risch is proposing a swap of about 39,000 acres of private timberland near Lolo Pass for the same amount of federal forest land near Harpster and Grangeville. The Lolo Pass land is owned by Western Pacific Timber, a major player in forest holdings throughout the West. The former railroad company land in a checkerboard pattern with Forest Service land has been logged over, and Forest Service officials have expressed interest in taking ownership of it to consolidate wildlife habitat. The idea of the exchange has been discussed since 2007. And officials who began exploring the proposal found the public was passionately opposed to it. Most opposition centers on the potential loss of Forest Service land prized for recreation further to the east. Some proposals would have given large parts of the Palouse Ranger District of the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest to Western Pacific, Other proposals would limit the exchange to land within Idaho County, which would mean Idaho County would continue to have a similar amount of Western Pacific land on its tax rolls. Second District Magistrate John Judge has postponed the preliminary court hearing for the man accused of robbing a Moscow bank last month. Prosecutors say Ibrahim E. Arar of Moscow robbed the Wells Fargo Bank on Blaine Street in mid-September. Police arrested the 31-year-old Arar September 24th. Arar waived his right to a speedy probable cause hearing yesterday, and judge rescheduled the hearing for Thursday, November 5th. Normally, probable cause hearings are held within 14 days of the first court appearance. Police say Arar wore a dreadlock wig and fake beard disguise during the robbery and took $2,335 in cash. The Lewiston Tribune reported Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson told Judge the prosecution is still processing evidence in the case and providing it to the defense. Arar's public defender, Catherine Mabbott, said the prosecution and defense are working on a possible resolution for the case. Prosecutors have charged Arar with one count of felony robbery, and he faces a possible prison sentence of 5 years to life and a $50,000 fine. Arar is being held in the Latah County Jail on a $100,000 bond. Washington Governor Jay Inslee told Department of Ecology officials yesterday to try again to update the state's clean water rules before the federal government does it for them. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is currently in the process of writing a rule regarding clean water regulation for the state, and Washington has less than a year to come up with its own regulations. Inslee rejected clean water rules offered by Ecology in July because he felt they did not adequately deal with the source of chemical pollution. The rules the department is developing regulate the amount of pollutants that factories, water treatment plants, and other facilities can discharge into the state's waters. Inslee said he is concerned about balancing the interests of the tribes, environmental groups, businesses, and cities. Washington Poet Laureate Elizabeth Austin will read from her work Monday at Neal Public Library in Pullman. Austin will hold the laureate position through next year. She will read from her works and then be joined by poet Kimberly Berwick, who is a Moscow resident and a creative Washington State University writing instructor. Austin's debut poetry collection, Every Dress a Decision, was a finalist for the Washington State Book Award. Monday's reading will be at 6 p.m. at the Neal Public Library, located at 210 North Grand Avenue in Pullman. We now turn to our featured segment, recordings from Wednesday night's Moscow League of Women Voters City Council Candidates Forum. The four candidates running for the three open seats on the six-seat Moscow City Council are Jim Boland, Dan Karskalin, Catherine Bonzo, and John Freeland. Here's some of their answers from the forum attended by well over 100 people Wednesday night at the 1912 Center, starting with moderator Roger Wallen.
With over 50% of the property in Moscow tax exempt, how will you control tax growth and maintain and or improve Moscow services?
Jim Boland.
The tax situation here where we have so much tax-exempt property does present us with a challenge, and Gary Reedner will be the first one to tell you that we're challenged on all sides in that respect. And so we're doing a lot with a little, and we're trying to be as efficient as we can with the resources that we have. And I think John is right that the more growth we have, the more opportunity we will have to increase tax revenue if we have more businesses doing more business here, that we will tend to grow. As the University of Idaho increases its enrollment, that will also improve the amount of business that gets done in this town and the amount of tax revenue that we get. And as the town grows, the property values will grow and the tax revenue will grow with it. So those are things that have to happen in order for our tax base to continue to grow.
Thank you. To Dan, please.
Dan Karskellen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Beacon on the Hill up there really, you know, it's our big economic driver, you know, because we, I think it's our biggest employer in town, so that it makes it hard to, you know, want to go up against them too much. You know, they might move to Amida or something if we are too hard on them. But that's one of the discussions we've always had at council, especially during budget time, you know, that we have half of our community is not taxed. There's expansion by annexation that we can bring other tax dollars into town. That's a little bit frowned upon by those that are potentially annexed, but you also take those city services to them, and that helps things out as well. Expanding the base, that's what we really need to do, whether it be with new businesses, new residents, however it is. You know, when you increase the base, you decrease the load on everybody else, and I think that's what where we need to be looking.
Catherine, please.
Catherine Bonzo.
A difficult question, but a very interesting one, too, because of our situation here. I was just going to give you a little perspective. When I sat on City Council in Troy, the water system was subsidized by the general fund, and we had that had been done that way for years. And so when I sat on council, we decided to have people pay for what they used. We also made it through a recall because the community was so upset, but we made it, and we're able to set things right. And I think people have an understanding. They do want to pay for what they use. I also think that we like to enjoy the services that the university and Gritman provide for us. They do a lot for our community. We have terrific health care in our community, and we have a wonderful university. And I think that there's a balance for that. We've all moved to this place because of its specialness. We have a great community, and part of it is the fact that we like the quality of life. We have this quality of life because we have a land grant university here, and we happen to have this nonprofit hospital. Those are facts. Then if we have to, as taxpayers, pay what we need to, that's what we need to do. It's a balance, and it'll always be a conversation, and it'll always be us trying to figure out the right thing to do. I also agree. I've looked at the maps and stuff. Area of impact is changing. We have more retired people moving here, and we want businesses to come here, so we are looking at different places, I think, of where we can put businesses in that we can tax. So I think, but then it's a complicated issue, and I think it is one area that we're going into.
Thank you. And John?
John Freeland.
You know, I think it is an issue that we need to think about and consider, but as I was recently told by one of our city councilmen, we currently have 3 months of operating expenses in the bank that's just sitting there and could be used for things such as roads and other things. I think one of the big things that, again, we need to talk about, though, is the declining, you know, student population here that's been going on. And the fact that every less student we have here in the community draws money away from the local businesses that are here. And that is an issue that is of great concern. And so we need a young person on the council who can work alongside leaders at the university, leaders in the state legislature, and can come up with policies, whether it be reducing tuition rates or whatever it may be, to be able to draw more students back into the community, which will benefit not only all of our businesses, but will increase our tax base as well, in terms of sales taxes, in terms of new development of properties and property taxes that are paid on those places. So it's about getting more people in here, not just students, businesses as well. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are pedestrian and bike paths important to our community is the first part. And the second part is, how do you feel about treating bicycles on the road as vehicles and encouraging law enforcement to warn or ticket the bicyclists as they would any vehicle that failed to obey the rules of the road.
Dan Karskellen.
Well, I'll give a two-part answer then.
Thank you.
I am in support of all our pedestrian and bike paths here in town. We did recently upgrade our Paradise Path Task Force to the Pathway Commission, so it's in the code now that it's an actual commission that is in charge of our pathways in town, in charge of. But they make the suggestions as far as interconnectivity of the paths, new pathways. They've come in with potential, trying to remember what they called it, orphan paths out there that they want to tie into the main one. So I do think that those are important. I think they get a lot of use. As far as bicycles on the road being treated as vehicles, I think that, you know, I've always been an advocate of that. My bicycle, I bought a license from the police department mostly so I could find it if it got stolen. That was the big thing. They had it work because my daughter's bicycle did get stolen, and they called me when it showed up at the city shop. So it does work for that. I think it's $6 now. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, I do think that they need to follow the rules of the road as everybody else. There is a couple little code sections, I think, that give bikes a little bit of extra leeway as far as stop and yield signs, things like that. But, you know, if the bikes are following the rules of the road, I think that we'll all get along better as far as that goes. We did put our sheros on down at Main Street, so hopefully, and trying to keep the bicycles off the sidewalks down there, because I think it says it's a pedestrian priority area, so bicycles need to help the pedestrians as much as the cars do.
Thank you. Jim?
Jim Boland.
I think that pedestrian and bicycle pathways are very important in this community, and I think we've done a good job of advancing that. We have fabulous trail system from Pullman all the way to Troy, and at some point it'll go all the way to Julietta, and it will be an economic engine as well as a great way for people to get around and recreate in this area. There are a number of pathway ideas going on that I want to see advanced. The underpasses under Highway 8 and Highway 95 would allow a biker or a pedestrian to get from the University of Idaho to the Joseph Street ball fields without ever stopping or going up a hill. And anything that you can do to make walking or riding bicycle, any human-powered conveyance, more convenient, the more people will do it and the less wear and tear there will be on our roads. As far as enforcement of laws relative to bicycles, cyclists have to follow the rules of the road. And like Dan said, they have certain exceptions. They're allowed to not stop at a stop sign if nothing's coming and treat that as a yield sign. That's one of them. But everybody, I think, has been afflicted with bike salmon. You know, those people riding upstream against the traffic. And that really shouldn't be tolerated. So, things should be enforced. And I've seen people get run into by a vehicle doing that because the motorist wasn't expecting them to come from that direction. So, they should follow the rules of the road.
Catherine Bonzo.
I'm originally from Alabama, so seeing people bike in the winter when I first moved here was quite a shock. But now that I feel like I've really become a Pacific Northwesterner, we have an increase of bikers. You have to remember, our city really is 2 miles square. So people do want to do that. We've had an increase. There's new labeling. I think that the education piece of the bicyclist has to happen too. And these two people are well-versed on their bicycling laws. But I think most people I ride, don't ride with lights. They don't pay attention. So I think there are some educational pieces that we could do to help the coordination between pedestrians, vehicles, and bicyclists. So it's on the increase in our community, which I'm pleased to see. We see a lot of people still riding without helmets, and I think that's something that we have to take into consideration, too, because then our emergency services bear the brunt of that if there's an accident. So this actually is a big city issue because I think as a city, and it's in the comprehensive plan too, the update of how many more people are bicycling. The city surveys were started in 2002, and they've been done every other year. We just had a new one. And there's about 1,500 people that received the surveys. And this is one of the questions. It is about are you using the bike paths, and are do you consider this a form of travel? And the results of the surveys are on the city website, and you can see that we are increasing that. And it's not just the university kids. We have a lot of hardcore bicyclists here.
And John, please.
John Freeland.
Thank you. I've been enjoying bicycling in this city since I was 8 years old when we moved here. I remember back in the day, every day after school, back when the Moscow Pullman Daily News still had afternoon routes, I had a newspaper out when I was in junior high for a couple of years, and every day I would go bicycle around the neighborhood and throw the newspaper to all the people who were on my list. That was a lot of fun. I've gone out so many times to Pullman, to Troy, on the trails with friends, with my brother and sister, with dates in some cases. It's a great activity, great place to go out with people. And just enjoy the community, the communities around us. We do need to be understanding with living in a university town with so many students who, some of them, their only real method of transportation is riding a bicycle. I've experienced driving around the city, you know, at times where a bicyclist was, going super slow or not following the rules of the road, and was actually being dangerous in terms of stopping cars suddenly or what not the issue may have been. And I think that's more an issue of education and needing to talk to people about the rules of the road and safety. But absolutely, I do support bicycling. I think it's a great thing in our community. And keep it up. It's a great energy-saving thing, too. So, yeah.
You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. One of the questions asked during Wednesday night's Moscow League of Women Voters City Council Candidates Forum referred to the anti-discrimination ordinance, which passed in 2013. The four candidates running for the three open seats, Catherine Bonzo, John Freeland, Dan Karskellen, and Jim Boland, answered the question. The city anti-discrimination ordinance bans discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in housing, employment, and public accommodations. There are exemptions for religious groups and for landlords renting the other half of a duplex they live in. Here's the answers from Catherine Bonzo and Jim Boland.
I've thought about this a lot. Equality, the symbol itself, the equal sign, is a balance. And when things are in balance, then we are able to have everyone sitting at the table. So to me in this day and age, to be discussing whether or not some people should be sitting at the table, again, is sad, but I think that is important for us to realize that everyone should be here. It's not an issue for me personally. And if it ever comes up before the council, I will make sure to state that it's not necessary. It's not part of our conversation. Again, that's another divisive question.
And I was going to give to Jim, but however you want to do it, I'm easy.
Restate the question, Roger.
Sure. Do you support non-discrimination against the LGBT community?
100%. I support non-discrimination against that community. I think we should not discriminate against anyone based on their race, religion, color, sexual orientation, or what they eat for dinner. I just don't think we should be discriminating against people.
That was Moscow City Council candidate Jim Boland, preceded by Catherine Bonzo. Here's the answers from candidates Dan Karskalin and John Freeland.
You know, it's the 21st century, and I can't believe that this is still something that anybody really wants to even discuss. I mean, people are people. Everybody's a little bit different. You know, Jim makes sausage. I like bacon. That's, okay. we passed a non-discrimination ordinance here in the city of Moscow a couple years ago. It's like I say, it's, you know, why are we even talking about it? I remember, and I don't know how many people have heard of The Onion or read it, but there was a story a few years back. You know, it's a satirical newspaper, and it was the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. And they, you know, it of course went along the same lines. I can't believe we're talking about this now. Let's move on to something important. So that's kind of how I feel. I mean, yeah, it's important to people, but it's unbelievable to me that it's even an issue. So I support non-discrimination in all types.
John?
No, I agree with that. I completely support non-discrimination. Whether it's a women's issue and women not being paid the same as men, or an issue for the LGBTQ community and people not being able to visit the people who they care about in the hospital, or whatever the issue may be, those are issues that we need to make sure as a community are resolved. We need to make sure that everybody has an ability to live their lives in a way in which they can feel valued as a member of society, and cared about and not discriminated against at all. So, thank you. Yeah.
That was Moscow City Council candidate John Freeland, preceded by Dan Karskalin. Another question at the Moscow League of Women Voters Candidates Forum Wednesday concerned whether marijuana should be legalized. Here's candidates Jim Boland and Catherine Bonzo.
I fully support marijuana legalization. It would be great if it be in Idaho. I think it's been a great economic engine in Washington and Colorado, and it's helped the schools to a great extent. In Washington, I think the number is like $358 million in the first 15 months of that. About $90 million of that has gone to schools. So I'd support it. I think it should be decriminalized. I think we spend way too much money prosecuting and incarcerating people for using a drug that's way less harmless than alcohol.
I spend a lot of time in Washington. I'm probably in Washington twice a week as I go and advise over at WSU. And I also agree in decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana. I think that it's just another substance that we can tax.
That was Moscow City Council candidate Catherine Bonzo, preceded by Jim Boland. Here's the answers from candidates Dan Karskalin and John Freeland.
Well, I agree that we ought to tax it, but I don't know that we can, even if if it's decriminalized or legalized or however, folks just aren't being able to get jobs that test for it, positive for it now. I know that, you know, maybe there's a level you can reach to use it and still be productive, but I don't know that a lot of businesses have found that yet, because I talked to my wife's cousin as recruiting over in Seattle. I think he's a subcontractor for Boeing, and evidently it's a lot more popular in Washington than I thought it was. Let's just put it that way. Because they can't get people to pass the drug test. And until they find a way that assures those employers that it's not a problem, I think it will still be a problem even if it is legalized. So there's that. But, you know, if we can raise some tax money out of that and fix some potholes, that'd be all right with me.
Well, I support decriminalization of marijuana. I think it's very unfair that people, young people, they have their entire lives ruined sometimes because they end up getting, you know, I believe in Idaho, the state laws, if you're caught with 4 ounces, it's a misdemeanor, 5 ounces, it's a felony. I'm pretty sure that's the number. And, you know, on a just a compassion and caring level as a society, I think it's very unfair that we throw young people in prison for doing something that really is not going to kill them. It's not potentially going to harm anybody else. And I take great issue with that. On the legalization issue, I'm not so sure that I want it legalized. I find that if it were to go on store shelves, that that might increase the ability of young people and their access to it. Obviously, I don't think that it's a wise decision to be on any kind of illegal drugs. I've never done illegal drugs at all in any way, shape, or form. And I think also that goes to just the argument based on that of having an upstanding young person in the community, in government, who can be an example and tell kids to say no to drugs, because that it can potentially ruin their lives. Not only sometimes, depending on the drug, not necessarily marijuana, health-wise, but it can also potentially at this point in time, because it's not decriminalized, potentially ruin their careers and even their lives. And that's something that needs to be addressed. So thank you.
That was Moscow City Council candidate John Freeland at the Moscow League of Women Voters Candidates Forum held Wednesday night at the 1912 Center. He was preceded by candidate Dan Karskalin. Voters can cast ballots for up to 3 of the 4 candidates in the race, and the top 3 vote-getters will be sworn in to 4-year terms in January. The Moscow City Council has 6 seats. Council members Walter Steed, Art Betke, and John Weber, as well as Mayor Bill Lambert, still have 2 years remaining in their terms. Well, Latah County voters can vote absentee in person at the Latah County Auditor's Office during business hours at the courthouse, 522 South Adams Street in Moscow. In-person absentee voting will be available at the courthouse until Friday, October 30th at 5 p.m. The deadline for requesting mail-in absentee ballots in Idaho is Wednesday, October 28th at 5 p.m. Voters can register at the polls in Idaho on Election Day. Polls will be open from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 3rd. Well, that's it for this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. Taking a look at the weather. Increasing clouds tomorrow, high 76. Breezy, light and variable wind becoming west, 15 to 20 in the morning with gusts up to 30. Saturday night, 30% chance of showers, mainly before midnight. Cloudy, then gradually becoming partly cloudy, low 48. Breezy, west winds 20 to 25, gusts up to 40 miles an hour. Mostly sunny Sunday, high 65, partly cloudy Sunday night and Monday, low 45, high 72. By the way, on Sunday, west winds 15 to 20 with gusts up to 25. Remember, all editions of the KRFP Evening Report are available for download and streaming on the KRFP website shortly after broadcast. Jim Roach and Alan Solon assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend. This is KRFP, Moscow Pullman, Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 and online.